a Rayo original podcast.
Emma Barnett, thank you very much for being here.
I'm actually quite nervous. My mum said to me when I told her about this, don't let it upset you, because we're both thinking it's going to be bad.
Are you ready to find out how old you really are?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm actually quite nervous.
Oh, Emma Barnett. Hello, I'm Katherine Ryan, and this is another fabulous episode of What's My Age Again? This is the podcast that asks our guests about their lives, lifestyles, and how they're getting on with getting on. In this episode, we are joined by journalist and writer Emma Barnett. Emma's 40 years old and is already at the top of her game. She co-presents Today, one of the country's leading news programs, which has her getting up at 3 a.m. and holding government ministers to account. Blech. How will all that hard work have impacted on her body? Emma is married with two kids and has been open about her fertility challenges, IVF, and living with endometriosis. She's filled in her lifestyle questionnaire. She's completed her biological age test. And of course, Dr. Nicola Conlon is with us to interpret her results. Emma Barnett, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Look at you, like, already flicking your...
Just getting into it.
...girlish little hair.
Well, I'm Barnett by name, Barnett by nature.
Yes,
know that.
Of course. And I live in Barnett.
Do you actually?
Yeah.
This is a Barnett production.
It is Barnett-themed. I don't really want to interview, I'll be honest, because I think you're such a professional, long-time, like, serious journalist, and I'm quite fat this present moment. Would you mind just doing a lot of the interview yourself?
I have been known to help people when they've run out of questions in life and on a mic.
You're a good wife. So I don't know where you'd like to start with this today in your interview. You've brought me some gifts.
I have brought you some gifts.
Some colouring books from your line.
Yes.
Your range.
Our range. It's nearly 2 years old, our colouring book company. Mm-hmm. My husband and I are now working together, which was not something I'd expected. But we've been together 20 years as well in September coming up. So yes, Colour Your Streets. We do local colouring books and bespoke colouring books.
Do you think the colouring's going so well because mental health is in the toilet? Do you think those two are related?
I think there are those elements, but I also think people want screen-free time.
Yeah.
And they also are very delighted by seeing where they live in a colouring book, because that hasn't been done before. And, you know, I remember this woman really early on wrote to us from Lincoln, and she said, I've never even seen, I mean, there's history books of the place, but I hadn't seen the name of where I'm from on a book. And I think, apart from maybe your own name, and maybe if you support a team... Yeah. There aren't that many things that get you as excited as your neighbourhood or your city sometimes, which I come from Manchester, so when I say that to people, they often follow it with, which football team, you know? And then we go down that road. But if it's not that way, there are other parts of where you live that you care about or other things. I think it's very exciting. Yeah.
I have a dog from Lincoln, and I think it's a popular baby name as well.
Oh, is it?
In America, okay. I think it's on the rise. You've also brought me Maternity Service, a very relevant book.
I know. Although, you know, you've done quite a few shifts of this now, a few tours of duty. So hopefully you'll just wryly laugh at lots of it and perhaps cry at other bits. I don't know. But it's a very thin book, deliberately.
Yeah, I noticed that. It's not intimidating. None of your books are intimidating. The way you would think an academic like you
I'm not an academic.
Would give me, like, you know, The Making of the British Working Class, like these thick anthologies.
It's funny you should say that. My first book, is called It's About Bloody Time, Period, I remember going in to pitch it, and I always say I don't have a desire to write books. I am predominantly a broadcaster, journalist, or an article writer. I want everything done really fast or live. But I say these books find me, and I hadn't yet, but then was diagnosed with endometriosis, and my period had been giving me a lot of grief, shall we say, and all the cycles to do with it and all those elements. And I remember going in to see this guy, and exactly to your point, one of the big book publishers, and he couldn't use the word period throughout the whole meeting, despite that being a history of and tales of women's experiences. And he I think he called it lady business the whole way through. And what he said was, I'll sign this. You can have your little lady business book as long as you will do me a proper, thick, sort of heavy, serious, historical, political book afterwards, because that's really what you're about. And I just thought, no, I'm also really about this.
Yeah.
And this is not, of course, to be with you, you know, and there was where the meeting ended. And obviously he did that thing that some men do when they're uncomfortable about women and their bodies, where he reassured me he had daughters.
Oh, yeah.
As relevant as absolutely nothing to any of these discussions, I find. But that was the end of the meeting.
You know, there are women in my life that I don't want to fuck. Therefore, I know what it's like to respect you.
That was the payoff I needed. We're going to make a good team, I think.
Yeah. Thick, heavy. I mean, it was right there in the endometriosis book.
The endometrium, yes. It was thick and heavy.
Well, let's get straight into that because I'm sorry, Emma. It's bad news for the biological test. I don't know what your results are, but I know from my own personal experience that autoimmune disease and inflammation
is not good.
It's really bad for your cardiovascular health or your bone density, but glycanage is really looking at inflammation.
And I'm screwed, aren't I?
You're inflamed.
Yeah.
So when did this start and how long did it take for you to get diagnosed?
So I have two inflammatory diseases. Well, I have one. I have endometriosis and I have adenomyosis.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Endo, I was diagnosed with at the age of 31. And I've been menstruating my career since 10. So 21 years. I didn't know, but I knew something was wrong.
Okay.
And adenomyosis was a couple of years later by a male gynecologist who said to me, oh yeah, you've got that, but it's the elephant in the womb. We know even less about it, and was very proud of his joke. And genuinely, because I was trying to deal with the endo and my infertility, I just couldn't be bothered to find out about that one. And I know a bit more now, but I also have a very strange relationship with these diagnoses because as someone who finds information for a living and feels like information is key a lot of the time, especially in the era we live in, I sometimes wonder about whether it's better to know one has something for which there is no cure or treatment. Because it's good to know you weren't imagining it, of course. It's good to try certain things and to know what has helped a few other women that you meet along the way, sort of your endo sisters in arms and all of this. But I also struggle when women come to me, and loads of women do each month talk to me. I struggle to know what to say because, you know, I got a lot of attention a few weeks ago when I said what I believe, which is that the doctors don't know anything. And it's not what I believe, sorry, it's factually accurate. Mm-hmm. Having seen 6 or 7 top doctors in the last 3 or 4 years.
I find it shocking that doctors, many doctors, aren't even willing to admit that they don't know anything. Because I think if I were in the business of pursuing science, I think the first admission would be, oh yeah, there's not enough funding into women's health. I don't really have the answer to that. I don't know. Rather than, yes, I do know. I've been doing this a number of years and you should put your child on the pill.
I think it's an excellent point. Yeah. I think it's very hard to say to somebody, though, when they're sitting across from you, if I was to give a more generous response, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I think saying to somebody, I don't know, but try this, it has helped some women, is not easy for the patient or the doctor. But it would be much more honest if a doctor, when giving you one of the many hormonal treatments I've tried in recent years, said to you, if this is like this, even just after a week, stop it.
Okay.
Because the amount of time to persist with something that isn't going to cure your disease, but allegedly may help, that you're meant to either be in pain for, feel like you're going mad because it's a hormonal treatment or whatever, I think more honesty and empathy around the treatment, well, I'm not going to say treatments, the attempts at treatments can offer would be so honourable.
Mm-hmm.
And I would greatly appreciate that. And I am someone who can hold people to account. I am somebody who is relatively knowledgeable now about what I can find out. And I think also a lot of doctors, having once given the keynote address to the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, I don't think I was the most enjoyed speaker. Having given that, they take themselves, of course, very seriously.
Yeah.
But they're very good at the science and medicine of getting women pregnant. And they are very good at the science and medicine of getting babies out of us.
Yeah.
And getting those babies out well. And of course, I'm grateful as someone who has 2 children and as someone who's had 7 rounds of IVF. But what they're less good at are all the unknowns.
I know. Is that why you chose to be so transparent about your experience, even with the IVF? Because I think that then, as a public figure, you can, and you're very clever, and it's, you know, worked for you in a way where you have this happy ending with your children, and you've got answers, maybe not solutions. So then you become someone, like a familiar face that people can go to with their own frustrations and ask questions to.
I mean, I don't provide answers to people when they do ask questions in quite the way that perhaps some maybe hope, but I have written a lot and tried to share a lot of what I have found. I didn't decide it. I feel that, again, a bit like the book topics, things find me and I refuse to be embarrassed and I refuse to be squeamish. I've never been squeamish. As a child, I was the one in biology dissecting the sheep's lungs with absolute gory glee. I briefly toyed with being a surgeon. You know, I wanted to be a barrister and I wanted to be an actor. Those things have in common. You are not scared of accountability, difficult things, weird things, all of the above. And I think when this all started happening to me, yes, I'm known also for my political interviews and news analysis or whatever around that subject, but I actually think the combination's very powerful. Mm-hmm. I find that the one thing I'm expected of means I sometimes get a different audience to so-called women's issues.
Yeah.
And women's issues are everybody's bloody issue because you're born of us and you live with us a lot and we look after you a lot, mm-hmm. or we don't. But, you know, I find that combination very powerful. Mm-hmm. And I've always been interested in how to get other people who need to listen to difficult messages or hard things in through the door.
Yeah.
And comedy does that a lot.
Tries to.
Well, it does. And yeah. I think you can get people, you know, you're someone who is saying very at times sort of stark things about being a woman, but you're doing it cleverly and you might not realise till the end of the gig, oh, that's what she meant by that. Mm. You know, and that's good. And men thinking that.
Do you think it's been difficult for you, or do you think it's provided a springboard that you started very young, very striking, like traditionally beautiful? I don't want to tell people when, you know, they're beautiful and not beautiful, but you know what I mean? Like blonde and very youthful looking and very pretty in this serious role, challenging older people, authority figures maybe. Do you think that that's been discombobulating for an audience as a broadcaster, or do you think it helps?
Well, I used to present Newsnight, and I would do that largely one night a week, sometimes two nights a week. But most of my broadcasting career, although even this is now visualised, we were saying before, has been on the radio. Mm-hmm. So my voice, since I've been about six, I don't know if it broke traditionally like a man then, but it's been very deep.
Was it this?
It was deep, yeah. I mean, I used to be, you know, often in a female-only environment or whatever and sound like the boy should be in 6 years' time of my own age. So often what I've found over the years is when listeners or other guests meet me, when I was in my 20s, for instance, they thought I was 45 or 55, you know, sort of this very deep voice. And because radio wasn't largely visualised for the first 10 years of my career, that was quite funny. And you could play with that, you know. And I think I have been, as an only child, a bit of an old soul. You know, I know you had your daughter for a long time as just you and her. And I think when you are just with adults eating your meal every night and you are not clamouring to get your voice heard, your very deep voice, you perhaps grow up a bit faster. But to your point around guests coming in, I actually, you know, the political side of my career, the interviewing side, it's funny, I studied history and politics at university, but I didn't sort of remember that when I was starting to interview politicians, because that was about the theories of power and how power worked, and quite a lot of it historical as opposed to present day. And then I realised, of course, I know a lot about this, just as someone who reads the news and enjoys culture and public life and reading about structures and psychology. But at the same time, here I was doing these interviews, and actually I attribute my cut through, if you like, my success at times to do with being from Manchester.
Okay.
Or that northern sensibility, the lack of reverence, unless it's earned. That sort of Oasis swagger that, you know, the dads are trying to find back to it.
Swagger.
You know, that sort of, however you want to define it, whichever character from Manchester. I mean, I'd probably go for Emmeline Pankhurst over Liam, although, you know, love Noel and Liam.
You could be a mix again.
You could be a mix of those. What a mix. But I think the lack of reverence allowed me to keep my head down and enjoy where you could go with that. How people responded to me, I don't necessarily know there and then, but I'm sure there were times where, because I always like a bright lip, I do like massive hair, you know, I hope to retire in Miami with really big hair, and like a golden girl, and I'm not going to compromise on those two things.
Yeah, and again, I think it's beautiful to be all of those things and to embrace them. People are accepting that more now, but I just imagined it would be difficult when you were 20.
I wasn't on some of the shows I'm on now, all the way I'm on now, but I suppose when I was 21, 22, I started probably around 25. But yeah, I mean, I take the point, but the facelessness of radio has been a gift at times.
So aging doesn't worry you then? You've always been an old soul?
Yeah, I think I might grow into the age I finally think I am. No, you know, I don't know. Age, let's talk about it properly, because there's elements of how you look and there's elements of how you feel. And I haven't felt as young as I want to feel since having children.
Okay.
I think I was listening to your conversation, which I greatly enjoyed, with the wonderful Dame Sheila Hancock. And she and you both talked about, or you certainly talked about, the minerals coming out of our bodies and the physiological impact. And I think that plus endometriosis and adenomyosis. And then going, do you know what I really regret? And if I'd known, it wouldn't have changed anything, but I regret...
The children, me too.
Oh, yeah. There you go, you got it. I regret not knowing what IVF was going to do to me.
Okay.
So 6 rounds, once you... What's weird about IVF is it's horrifically grueling and emotionally unfun, to say the least, and physically hard. Yeah. But the finish line is pregnancy, if you're lucky, or not, and then it's horrific. But that's not a breeze either. You're obviously very grateful. You're very stressed. It's going to work out. And then the finish line of that is a baby. So you never get to recover from IVF in quite the way you would from any other medical procedure.
I guess it always fails.
So you just, you know, and I say this with huge awareness that I got there. But I do think my body at 2.5 years on is still reeling from 6 rounds of IVF back to back.
Well, you got small kids. How old are the kids?
2.5 and 7.
I mean, yeah. I think there are studies that say you don't physically recover for 2 years from a pregnancy. You don't begin to...
Really?
Yeah. And then if you're also looking after a 5-year-old, come 7-year-old in that time, now you've got a toddler now who's undoubtedly sassy. Like, this is the trouble with raising strong women.
There's a lot going on.
Is that you are their first obstacle. Like, yes, just really difficult.
You could tell me more. Yes, I'm learning again. But, you know, I think I haven't quite. And so I'm looking forward, ironically, to getting older to feel better through some of these things, if that makes sense.
I know exactly what you mean.
And then looks-wise... You know, people talk to me like, would I ever do, you know, and I never say never about Botox and all these things, but I can't imagine it because I don't have any piercings, I don't have any tattoos.
Yeah.
I have used more needles than should be legal because of IVF. So the thought of any needles coming anywhere near me and on my face unnecessarily, which is how I view these sorts of things unless they're required correctively because of medicine or whatever, I can't bother with that.
Well, you're lucky, actually, because I think filler is a young woman's game.
Is it?
In your 20s, if you want to try to get the Kylie Jenner jawline,
right,
that looks nice on Instagram. But I think women our age,
not good.
You've seen it.
Okay.
They get lost in the filler game, and it ages you.
And then I read this great piece by Anna Murphy in The Times, where she did this brilliant sort of, she applied proper journalism to this subject.
Mm-hmm.
And there are loads of elements of it. People can look it up. But one part which has stayed with me is that, and it's an obvious thing now you say it, but if you do here, if you do your face, you need to keep going. Like, it has to connect. Yeah. And I'm like, well, where would it end?
It's the hands. My mother sleeps in gloves that are filled with Vaseline.
Does she actually do that?
Yeah. I mean, the film The Substance was not a huge departure from, like, what I've been growing up with. She's just like, the hands. But she's always been big on hands and SPF.
And Vaseline's the thing. Could be a thing. Okay.
She has nice hands. The décolletage mattered to the feet. I mean, but I think that what my mother didn't have, and I use her as an example because I think she is the archetype, like, for very beautiful, glamorous, traditionally sexy, small, submissive. Yeah. Like, she did all of the things that her daughters grew out of, and hopefully our daughters even grow further away from. But she sacrificed a lot of her career ambitions and dreams, you know, to fulfill just that role. As you said, she didn't know that she could be many things. Mm. Your career, obviously, is so impressive, but also seems really stressful. Like, Sinead O'Connor threatened to quit because of you.
Yeah, there's definitely been reactions to interviews.
Yeah, you upset people. Some people refused to be interviewed by you.
Yeah.
Managing that career stress, and I know you were the girl who was dissecting the lamb's intestine and lung. You know, have you always been a bit impervious to criticism? Is that okay for you, or does it stress you out the way it does? If I tell a joke and I get pulled up on it by a celebrity or organization, which has happened, I do feel sad. I don't actually want to hurt people.
No.
So when Sinead O'Connor, for example, threatens to retire, do you stay up at night and go, oh my gosh, I've taken it too far this time?
I mean, that particular interview, which people never listen to in full.
I haven't listened to it. I'm not saying you did take it too far.
But I always find it very interesting that a lot of people, when they bring up various things from my interviews, haven't listened to them. So not you necessarily, but I actually mean on social media.
Yeah.
And then I don't engage at all with people online who haven't listened to something in full.
Yeah.
And if they listen to that particular interview in full, I'm sure they'll have a very interesting view of it. And my point, I suppose, about her or about anyone else is, I absolutely adored her book. And we did a really interesting interview and a really good conversation. Is unlike, and I mean there's no disrespect to podcasters writ large and that whole world, because I listen a lot and enjoy a lot of material, is as a journalist, one has to ask questions that you need to ask of all sorts of people. And the thing that I don't mean any disrespect by, but that we now are living in a world where politicians interview politicians on their podcasts. Ed Balls interviews his wife on morning TV, who happens to be the Home Secretary. Ed Balls has a wife, sorry to disappoint you. And I'm happy I made you laugh. Okay, that's a good win. And footballers interview their teammates.
Yeah.
That's not accountability. No. That's not a real conversation like it will be if I come along or someone I work with and I've done all my research. And there's an important sentence in journalism, without fear or favour. Mm-hmm. And I will go there. And I will go, I work for my listeners. And I work for the principle of journalism. And I will ask those questions. And I will answer what you said about how I feel about when people come back. But very early on, I had to understand, unlike, you know, certain people who set up shows on YouTube, podcasts, whatever, I'm not going to make friends out of my job. Mm. I have my friends. They are my friends. I'm not saying I can't add to those friends. I don't have a lot of energy to add to the great set I have.
No, you don't.
I don't have a lot of time. And to be frank, I'm a pretty tough judge of character. And I'm sure I know I'm Marmite. So I'm not everyone's cup of tea. You're not queuing around the block to necessarily be my friend. I'm not saying that. One isn't. But I am not someone who needs to be made to feel good by the people I interview. That is not who I'm doing it for. I just had a woman cycle past me on the way here. I think she was about 65, 70. She looked really cool. Grey hair on her, flapping under her helmet. And she was like, I love what you do, Emma. Now that is going to...
hit by a bus.
I hope she was okay. But that is going to hold me the next time there is someone on the internet who hasn't listened or has listened and really doesn't like it and still sends me a C-U-N-T message.
Yeah.
I have to try and hold that against that. Now, in answer to your question, I'm still human. And of course, when people feel I get things wrong, because of course I do, or they don't quite like the way I did something, it's hard. But one has to take that with what I do. And also, I mainly broadcast live. So I'm making a million decisions. Mm-hmm. The people around me are making a million decisions. You're a live performer. you go off the energy in the room, that can be so different out of the room. And the phrase that gets me through, in case it's helpful to anyone, is those who matter know, and those who don't usually don't.
No,
but it's harder to live by. I'm not impervious to criticism. And I think also you asked me about aging, and I realized that the majority of the last decade, having just turned 40 a few weeks back, I have either been trying to get pregnant, being pregnant, losing babies, or having maternity service, as I like to call it. And you're out of the game a lot. So you got to keep your nerve and believe you can do what you can do. Women have to leave their entire jobs, go and do this crazy thing, mm-hmm. then actually parent, and return as if it's completely normal. And you understand why women have crises. One can understand why that scenario leads to a crisis of confidence.
Yeah. And I couldn't agree more. I'd much rather be Marmite than toast. And I try to go into my job with the same mantra that you do. But I think I would have a harder time if it was serious political interviews like you're doing. And the Sinead O'Connor reference that I made, again, I haven't listened to the interview. Presumably it was, you asked her something about mental health. I think it's very fair to ask Sinead O'Connor something about mental health. And she canceled her retirement 2 days later, so she was ultimately fine with it. But I'm just saying, like, do you believe that becoming a mother and going through all the IVF, because on a biological age test level, I'm trying to understand the underlying stress that you would have contributing to the inflammation. Do you think that it's true what they say about baby brain and about becoming more maternal and about postpartum vulnerability, that maybe you would be less impervious to this criticism?
Well, there's a few things in there. I mean, stress generally, the stress that is in my life from my work isn't predominantly from critics.
No.
Or guests. Or those who won't speak to me. Like they won't speak to most journalists.
Maybe the easiest one.
Yeah. They don't appear. Donald Trump, as much as you try. But I still open to that if you listen to
Will he
Trump.
Not be interviewed by
no,
you?
No, it's hard to get an interview with the president.
Could you not put on like a bandeau dress? You could trick him,
Catherine,
Emma.
Catherine, I've got to get it my own way now, you know, in this denim tunic I'm wearing, this double denim.
Fine. I'm a little bit old school.
Yeah,
I'd be like, Emma.
All right, we'll think about this. That you're suggesting. My main stress comes from, with the job I do now, so I present the Today program.
Yeah.
You get up at 3:21 in the morning. That is horrific. 21 is the thing that's a hangover from my youth. I like getting up on odd numbers. It's bloody weird. Anyway, I feel it's like a minute back from the system. Like, it was at school. Oh, I can get up like a minute later. It's great.
So what?
That's a whole insight.
You get up at 3:21?
I get up on an odd number.
Oh. So three.
It's the only, like, Rain Man thing about me.
So it can't be four?
No, I get up at 3:21.
3:21.
I like a one or a three.
All right. That's fine.
It's odd.
But neurodivergence? Have you been tested for that?
No.
Okay.
But no, there's no other part of me that seems neurodiverse. So I'll just have this one thing and that can be my
thing. I think all of it, but that's fine.
Okay. But I get up early. It's obviously hell. I like go into the loo, sit on the toilet, you know, do the first wee of the day and stand up and then start waterboarding myself with what Putin's done overnight, you know, Trump's done.
Oh, no.
You start with the international news because you're going to do some of those interviews before you go on air because of the time difference of when American commentators and guests are up. And so you get in the car and you are constantly just reading briefs at 3:45 all the way to work. You walk in the door at 4:08, 4:09 roughly. It's the same every day.
Hopefully 4:09.
Yeah, you get your tea and you're at your desk. And the stress comes from getting all the information into your head. Because then at 6, you go live to millions and millions of people for 3 hours. And you're going to be served up the guests you know about and the guests you don't know about. And so you are in a situation of live broadcasting. Now, if you were really stressed all the time and that was your job, you shouldn't do that job. I think the funny thing is how I'm not stressed a lot of the time. But I've realized that's where the stress comes from. Weirdly, once I go live, I'm not that stressed.
Okay.
It's the 2 hours before of getting all of it into my head.
While there's no sunlight.
I mean, there's a bit at the moment, but yes, we're talking in August.
Yeah, you'll have to tell
5 a.m., you start to get 4:45, you get a bit.
But on a biological level, I think your whole endocrine system, you know, the melatonin is cut short and then you're up. But yeah.
It's not good.
We'll find out.
It's definitely not good. And I did this test, I think, about 7 months into the job, so.
And also, I do feel, I hate to say dumber, but I put milk in the laundry room the other day, like in pregnancy and in a postpartum state, which you're very much still in with a two-year-old. I don't know how your brain is bouncing back.
Well, there's a great book by my friend and journalist Lucy Jones called Matrescence. Mm-hmm. And in it, she presents, and matrescence is the process of becoming a mother, but it's a physiological thing. Mm-hmm. And I did not know a lot of the science till I read that book. So I agree with you about the changes. We know factually the grey matter changes amount depending on where you are in that cycle and that things adapt so you are caring. You know, there are things that nature's trying to do to you that you can resist, you can fight, you can... So I fully agree that there are changes.
Yeah.
I find a lot of refuge in my work from parenting, from other parts of life, and from my conditions mm-hmm. and from being in pain. And I think years of training myself to concentrate when I'm in pain perhaps has helped with fighting what you've described with one's brain when you... I mean, obviously, straight after having a baby and for 8 months the first time and 9 months the second time, I wasn't at work.
Yeah.
But I did go on air 12 weeks after having our first child, our son, to present a program which was the Andrew Marr program. It's a Sunday morning politics program. I was asked to stand in. And you know, credit to the man, and it was a man who was editing it at the time, who still asked me to do it. He knew I'd had a baby. He didn't treat me like I'd died. He said first refusal, because I'd said to you if Andrew was ever off, and I think he was due to a medical situation, I'd come to you. And he still did. And I did it. And I have to say, while breastfeeding, pumping, and reading about the Brexit agreement, those three things in the BBC sort of green room or prep room, wherever I was, were unusual. And actually being on TV, because I typically was doing radio at the time, 12 weeks after giving birth, you know, all those things were really, really hard. I'm not going to deny that.
Yeah.
I hadn't read the news for 3 months, and then I was presenting a political program and interviewing the ministers that day. So, you know, there are different moments that would present different stress. And I recognise in your world, you don't get a maternity leave from a job. You're freelance, presumably.
But I don't have to know about Putin. So it's pretty good.
I haven't read your latest material. But
yeah, there's no Putin in it. I think maybe you have just this warrior pattern to your DNA then, where you get stressed a little bit before work, and then it is maybe endorphins and this release where you're very calm. What do they call it? There is a name for it that someone explained to me, that when I'm on stage, I'm actually really calm and I'm not thinking.
Yes.
And I think maybe in live broadcasting,
you go in the same.
Yeah, you're in this trance where, oh, there's a name for it.
Okay.
You see?
We're going to have to find that
out. Stupid. But that's what you do. You're probably in this very effective, you let muscle memory take over, and there's a part of your brain that's doing all of those unexpected guests and interviews. You've had this stress before, and hopefully that's purging it.
But also, isn't it going to be the same for you as well around, you know, 10,000 hours of practice? So that you've done something so many times.
Maybe.
You know, there's that saying, isn't there, you know, it took me 20 years to do this well in 15 minutes.
Well, I hope you're not like me, because my biological age is 77.
Is it actually?
Yeah. Okay. And the highest it goes is 80.
Great, okay. Well, this will be interesting.
I know.
I met a woman on holiday, just came back, who has just turned 50, and she was so upset about it. And she, you know, not to be reductive of her, but she looked fantastic. She was in great shape. She was a mum of a teenage girl and a 9-year-old boy. And she started, I think, having kids at the end of her 30s, beginning of her 40s. And it was so funny because she seemed amazing. And I went, well, I feel 50 and I just turned 40 and I'm thrilled about like where I am. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't mind. And it was just, I felt like how I felt versus how she obviously felt great but was so upset about her age.
Right.
She said 50 has hit her really hard.
And how did 40 hit you? Not at all.
I think, I don't know, it is older. Like, of course it's older, and I think perpetually, I don't know what age you feel in your head always. What, do you have an age?
I'm like you. I think Golden Girls is aspirational.
Yeah, Blanche, let's be Blanche.
Yeah, I feel it in my 40s. And I agree with you as well that having kids,
yes,
it's fun and they can keep youthfulness about you because you're playing a lot and you're very physically active. But I do notice having been a mother at 24 and being a mother at 42.
It must be so. Is it very?
I do have less energy and mobility and will to live.
And you've seen the movie before.
Yeah.
I think at 40, I feel it's an achievement in many ways. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested by it. Mm-hmm. But I'm still really waiting for a better bill of health generally. And I therefore can only think that getting older will be good.
I think that too. So you've got many stressors, but you've also got many lovely releases. And you're very fulfilled in your career, in your marriage, presumably. You've embarked upon a business with this man.
Yes, Jeremy and I are now working together.
You hope to continue that?
Yes, okay. The marriage and the business. Yes, we met at university, and he is a natural-born entrepreneur, and I've always known that, and he's done other ventures, and this is the first time doing something together, but it's very complementary to what we both do. And I do think, having grown up with someone, which is what I have done with him, that, and now, you know, he was incredible during the last 8-9 years of what we had to go through and what we are going through with my health, that, you know, it's sort of really... It's hard to analyze life without him because it's me, you know, we are in that place. And I remember meeting him and thinking, people who say they just know when they know, I mean, who are these people? Mm. And I know I was only really young when I met him, but I still had a very cynical view of that. Like, how could you, of course you don't know. You just, you grow up a bit more together, or you have a moment that's not just one moment. It has to be many moments, but I did know. And I was quite shocked, and I was also quite disappointed because I hadn't finished dating. Okay. I hadn't, like, you know, I was at university and I thought, oh God, he's the guy. And I went on a date with him in London, and as I say, it'll be 20 years in September. And I texted a friend quite drunkenly afterwards and said, I'm going to marry him that night. And she had the text when we got married. She showed it to me all those years later, as in to prove I hadn't just made a silly romantic story to fit my reality. But I knew.
Well, you seem to be someone who gets what she wants, finishes what she starts.
I think there's nothing like infertility to test that. And I did get there in the end, but I'm extremely humbled by that whole experience because it is the first time that I've failed at things. Of course, I haven't gone for things if I don't think I can get them. That's also how people continue to look at success, don't they?
Do you think you're someone who would have had 30 rounds of IVF?
No.
Did you have a limit?
It's a great question, and very few people ask me that. I didn't think I'd be a woman who did 6. So, no. My limit was the round before where we finally got pregnant and I had a miscarriage. Oh. And I was like, I'm done. Like, that was it. And my friend who lived down the road, and this incredible friendship that I did not expect, a late one to add into the group, as I say, not open really for trying to field any new emotions from anyone else. I like to be a good friend. So, you know, I want to not be over capacity, but Dr. Katie, as we call her, she's not a doctor of fertility, but she was going through IVF at the same time. And she and I happened to miscarry at the same time. And she was the one who convinced me to go one more time, only in a way that a doctor could. No other friend, if they had had any other profession, would have said what she'd said after the miscarriage, which was, so we had the baby, the fetus tested, which was advised by doctors to do with me gynecologically, which was great advice. And it actually showed that the baby wouldn't have lived beyond 2. And that meant, in the sense of, for Katie, how she sort of then talked to me about it was, well, you know, your body did what it was sort of meant to do in some ways at this point, because it would have been a very hard life for this child. Mm-hmm. And it was a particular condition. And she said, but what's amazing is the IVF finally worked again. And you need to now repeat, as we would in science, the procedure again. And I said, can I swear? I'm on the BBC, I never do. I said, well, you need to fuck right off because I am not going back in that boxing ring again. Like, I am fucking done. And Katie was a woman who would do 30 rounds. I don't want to speak for her, but she was hell-bent. And I actually, being an only child, was like, I can step out now. Like, I have one child. I won the lottery.
Yeah.
It's you know, the only feedback I ever got when I wrote publicly when it was going wrong at the time that was negative was I was told I was greedy by some people.
Fine.
But I went into that place. I was like, I've won. Not that it's about winning, but I've got this child. What are you doing? Where am I in this? I'm so unhappy. You know, this is horrendous. And it was Katie, like two more rounds the park, three more cans of beer kind of thing, because we used to go walking with beer. It's lovely. it was end of lockdown. And I came back and my husband went, oh my God, we're going again. Okay, are we? I was like, yes, we are going one more time. And that was going to be, and that was the round that delivered our daughter.
There you go. And you deserve a daughter. Be greedy and get that daughter.
Thank you.
Yeah? You're a firstborn daughter, an only child, but you still have like the strongest main character firstborn daughter energy ever. So what's the plan? You're finished having children. I believe I am also hopefully finished having children.
You know, one never knows, I suppose. Or do they?
I think medicine at this point would be like...
I meant in your scenario, because you've gone a few times now.
Yeah. But what's the plan? What's the plan for the endometriosis? What's the plan for the glow up?
Yeah.
You look amazing. But this podcast, I think a lot of people, especially when they see that I'm hosting it, they think age is an aesthetic thing.
Yeah.
But what's my age again is quite the opposite. We get to the core of like biological age, but also how young you feel and how vivacious you are. Have you got, now that your family is complete, a plan? Are you going to approach, because I know women have had hysterectomies to avoid some symptoms of endometriosis. You're not going to get needles in your face. No tattoos on the pipeline.
Yeah, although if you see me in 10 years' time and I'm full of filler and I've got loads of tats, you'll know something's gone completely wrong. Or awry, shall we say.
Where's Jeremy?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where is he?
Do you have an age that you think you will be close to the Miami Golden Girl? You'll be on holiday with the kids. They will be self-sufficient. They'll be getting their own apple juice.
Where we can actually fly them to somewhere like Miami and I don't arrive 10 years older just from the flight. That would be a good starting point.
Medically, what does that look like?
Yeah. Okay, so the medical thing is unknown really at the moment. I have tried to hack my inflammation through cutting out ultra-processed food. I've done intermittent fasting. So then what happened with that, just to say, after coming back to work, after our daughter, was I lost a lot of weight, which wasn't the goal. It's always interesting to me. I've never dieted. I'm not interested in any of that. It was kind of a feminist rebellion. Because I'm not a stick, you know, but I'm not overweight. I kind of ended up being a bit sort of, without meaning to, you know, losing a lot of weight. And then I've been strength training with an amazing trainer called Frankie Hola, where I live. She's expert in postnatal. I've been doing that twice a week for 2 years, coming up to as well. Which
since your daughter was born, basically.
7 months afterwards, I started that. I was desperate, Catherine, to help my body.
Okay.
So the first time I've gone to help my body, which resulted in visually looking, ironically, a lot healthier, stronger, whatever, I was still really poorly. So the intermittent fasting, the diet changes, they help, but they don't help enough.
Okay.
So I have been embarking along hormonal, at first synthetic, and now bioidentical hormonal support, which comes in a range of ways when it's to do with endometriosis. Mm-hmm. I don't see a hysterectomy on the cards for me at the moment, and I really don't mind talking about that. I've always tried and be really clear. I suppose it's the public service broadcaster in me that it's not a cure. And my endometriosis, the last time it was looked at sort of laparoscopically through an operation, was actually all over my bowel. So if I had a hysterectomy, it might alleviate certain symptoms. It would help the adenomyosis because that's in your womb, but it wouldn't help everything. I'm just looking forward at the moment to finding a good hormonal support system that can help me get to as better place as possible, especially heading into perimenopause. And I'm also hopeful of when that system finally fucks off for good, naturally.
That's nice.
I mean, there is no more detailed plan than that. And still trying to eat well. I don't do the fasting anymore.
Yeah.
It was quite extreme what I tried to do. I really liked a book called Fast Like a Girl by Mindy Peltz. Mm-hmm. I think she's amazing. I think there's a lot of goodness from that. But I personally, with the time I get up and small kids and hormones and endo, I can't do that.
Yeah.
But I did it for a while and I found it really helpful to understand what agreed with me and what didn't.
Okay. So there's still an exploration there. You have no plans to start having a lie-in.
I don't think I can sleep past 5:45, which was the time the time I used to get up for woman's hour was around then.
Yeah.
So I think, because I am a 10 a.m. broadcast woman for 15 years, I'm like programmed to get up at a certain time.
And what time do you go to sleep?
Well, I used to be a night owl, which is a bit of a problem. Now, on the second night of the shows, I always go to bed when I'm meant to, which is 8:30.
Like with the children, kind of?
Yeah, like an hour afterwards
or
whatever. But on the first night, because I have a rebellion mentality that is so not serving me, 9:30 or 10.
Because you know what? With kids especially, and you're trying to be a friend and you're trying to be a wife, it's difficult to get that time for yourself.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the rebellion.
Yeah.
It's like you rebel at that point.
Yeah.
Because when is there you? Yeah. And there needs to be you. But I have a weird schedule on the days I do the program. I obviously don't do it 5 days a week. I do it 2 or 3 days a week, which means I do get to go to art galleries, which is one of my great loves.
Good.
At 10 a.m. and no one's there in the week. It's fantastic, as an example.
Mm.
Or I go and do like, you know, a bit of exercise. This is when I'm not doing training. I'm basically awful if I don't have an appointment. And I'll go to like an infrared sauna or have my hair done, which I like doing each week. That's kind of my hack, that I have my hair blow dried every
week. Your hair is stunning. So you
That's kind.
You're one of these women. I mean, it's not kind. It's just a fact. You get it blow dried because I'm interested. I've been working alongside the Housewives of London.
Yeah, okay.
I think you'd like them.
This is the new program, right?
Yes.
Okay, I've not seen... Is it out yet? Sorry.
It comes out. Well, yes, it's out.
It's out. Sorry, we can say that now.
It comes out today.
I will watch this to check in.
It's funny. One of my main takeaways was a lot of these women, as a self-care ritual, they get a blowout once a week and they don't own shampoo and conditioner. Is this you?
A blowout also, whenever you say it in a Canadian or American accent, makes a British woman think of something else, which I greatly enjoy.
A blowout? What do you call it?
You say blow dry.
Oh, a blow dry.
A blowout sounds like you're doing something else
a
to me.
A blowout. Like fellatio or having a party?
Fellatio.
Oh. Blowout. Yeah, no,
I don't know.
That.
It's just something about it because it's not what we say. So you think it's going somewhere else,
right?
I do own shampoo. My hair actually naturally, people tell me, is quite lovely. I think I look like a bit of a hedge. It's wavy. It's very wavy.
Do you know what it is? Which is unfortunately not an indication of a good test, but I feel like it should be. Is your hair is very youthful? It's shiny. It's got a good weight to it.
I've got a lot of hair.
Yeah, you've got a lot of fine hair.
Got a lot of fine hair. Yes, you know that. I love that. You know that.
And your skin is really youthful looking. Your eyes are really sparkly, but you could still be
haggard.
Really
on
haggard.
My inside.
Yeah.
Well, but I stopped having my nails done 5 years ago. That was the thing I gave up. So hair for nails. Time. The amount of time.
Time.
I
Very
switched.
Shrewd.
Time and budget.
Okay.
So, but I'm so intrigued that they don't own shampoo, those women.
They don't. Some
I
of them.
Love that detail.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of my faves. We're going to bring out Dr. Nicola Conlon
and
reveal the results of your biology.
I like that your pod has a reveal. It gives it a sense of drama.
Science and drama. I know. Are you ready to find out how old you really are?
My mum said to me when I told her about this, don't let it upset you. Because we're both thinking it's going to be bad.
How old do you think it's going to be?
I think it could be in the 50s.
Which is not bad.
No.
Considering...
It could be in the 60s. I'm trying to like be optimistic.
I don't know, but considering your documented inflammation...
Yeah.
The fact that you do serious interviews, you don't sleep, you have small children...
It's bad, isn't it?
Anti-Semitism on top of that. How's it going? How's the anti-Semitism for you these days?
It's higher than normal if we're doing a weather forecast.
Yeah, quite high.
So, yeah, there are the layers.
But that will cause a low-level stress response.
Okay.
And that's what I'm worried about.
Yeah, great.
I think you might be like a duck, that you look very serene and you do your job really effectively, but You do have inflammation. Something might be happening under the surface. We're going to find out.
Can you actually ask the doctor this, but can you get it down?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
That is the whole point.
Right.
Nicola. All right. Emma.
Yes?
Emma Barnett. It's time to find out how old you really are.
Okay.
We're now joined by Dr. Nicola Conlon.
Hi.
I know you don't have time for friends, but you like to make friends with lady doctors.
Oh, yeah, experts. I'm all in.
Yeah.
Good.
Science woman.
Yeah.
And Nicola's going to help us interpret the results. This is a test done by Glycanage.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm actually quite nervous.
I know. It's an envelope.
Also, but it's you with a shiny gold envelope, so I feel it's... Yeah.
You win.
It's there's a competition here.
Your chronological age is 42?
40? 40.
40?
Yeah,
You're 40?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Okay. You're younger than me or smarter than me?
No.
Prettier than me?
I'm not going with that because I don't know what's in that envelope especially.
Oh, Emma Barnett. Your result is 67 years old.
Jeez, okay. Really?
And that'll be just because of the inflammation.
Oh,
and don't
my days.
Forget, I'm 77.
Oh, gosh.
67.
What inflammation is going on with you? Is it similar?
I have lupus. I have celiac.
Okay, several things.
I'm also a firstborn daughter, but I'm not a scientist, so I'll hand it over to Nicola.
67?
Yeah. I mean, I think we kind of knew that this is what was going to come back. And just to let you know, this is one way of measuring biological age.
Yeah.
And this specific way does look at inflammation. And we know because of the endometriosis, you do have higher levels of inflammation in the body. But if we did a different type of test, you know, that could come back completely different when we're looking at different biomarkers, because there's many different ways to look at biological age. Mm. But just for people that maybe don't understand exactly what endometriosis is and the reason why it might lead to inflammation in the body, it's basically when some of the cells that are in your womb end up growing in places in the body other than the womb. And the cells in our womb, as we know, they every month are changing and then they're shedding and then we have a period, but those cells are then still doing that, but as you said, in other parts of the body. So this triggers inflammation because it shouldn't be happening in those parts of the bodies. But the good news is that as I think you were chatting earlier and you asked, is it reversible and are there things you can do about it? And there absolutely are. And for me, looking at because you filled in a little health questionnaire, and looking at that health questionnaire, you're doing everything right. You know, you are really
and I'm still
doing
fucked.
Everything. No, but I think what you have to consider is as well, you know, you spoke very openly about doing 6 rounds of IVF and how that's made you feel. And that, you know, I think you said, I was listening, you said you still don't feel that your body has recovered.
Right.
And as you said, it's like it's IVF and then it's pregnancy and then it's young children. And we know all of these different things also can really take the toll on the body when it comes to driving inflammation. So I think it's important to understand that it seems like over the last, the last decade, you really have had a lot of stress on the body. Mm. But these are all things that can be mitigated with lifestyle. Mm. And the only thing that did worry me was the shift work.
Mm.
And that's obviously not something you're ever going to be able to do anything about.
Oh, no. I mean, you don't have to do the breakfast program in your life for life. But
yeah.
It is this part of life.
So. Exactly. But everything else you're doing, you know, you're getting to bed early. So you still get in. I was trying to add it up in the back. You said you were going to bed about 8:30, sometimes a little bit later. But you're still getting around 6 to 7 hours, which as well with young children is amazing.
Oh, yeah. They're not allowed to leave their room or make any sounds on those nights.
Good.
But
that's
still
good.
What does it do to your cortisol and to your endocrine system to be waking up when your body knows, like, your circadian rhythm must be disrupted by that, right?
Yeah.
Because aren't there studies that show shift workers do have more inflammation or they suffer in some way?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a known fact. So we do know you've got your circadian rhythm, which is like your 24-hour sleep-wake cycle, and it's actually controlled by the sunlight and what light exposure you're having in the morning and in the evening. Mm. It sort of, it like triggers the body to start its cycle again, its 24-hour cycle. So when you're sort of moving around with different bedtimes or different sleep-wake cycles, it kind of disrupts that natural pattern. And we do know that in people that do shift work, especially over prolonged periods, around there's a statistic which looked at a very large study. I think it was actually women, interestingly, this study, of 2,500 women showed that for every 10 years that they did shift work, they saw an increase in biological age by around 3 years. Mm. So we do know it affects it, but that's only one part of it. And the bit about your lifestyle, which I was like, thank goodness, is that you said you've cut out ultra-processed food.
Because as much as I can.
I mean, it's impossible to not in this world, you know, not eat anything processed. But again, there is some research that shows that in women who do have a lot of ultra-processed food in the diet, specifically trans fats, that their symptoms of endometriosis actually increase. And we know because these types of diets are incredibly pro-inflammatory.
Yeah.
And they almost are driving that inflammation and making it worse. So the fact that you've cut that out, amazing. Can I ask, do you take anything like omega-3 or anything?
No, the only thing, two things I take at the moment, because I was trying to introduce things one by one to see an impact, is I take magnesium and I take an iron supplement.
Yeah.
Because my iron is low.
So omega-3 might be something to look at. So like a really good high-quality fish oil. Because when I knew we were doing this episode, I started doing a little bit more research just into the condition, because obviously it's not an area of expertise for me.
Or anyone.
Do you know what? Really interestingly, so I was looking. So when I do research, you know, you're looking at the number of papers and studies that are published. And interestingly, there seems to have been a surge in 2025 of research into this particular condition.
There was a level of funding that was done, and forgive me, I can't remember the name, or I think it was in America, but by a female philanthropist, has given millions. And I was interested to see if that will then lead. And there's also this amazing piece of research being done in Scotland by Professor Andrew Horn, which I'm part of the cohort for, called Endo 1000, which again, I think will have been started in the year that you've... Did you just say the last 12 months?
Yeah, there was actually a couple of studies that have been published. And, you know, you can see when you look at on like PubMed and places like that, how many papers have been published, and it was like literally nothing. And then it's really going up. So it's quite exciting to see that we're now getting a lot more research put in to specifically endometriosis, but just, you know, women's health in general. I mean, from my background, used to be in drug development, looking at the number of clinical trials that actually even had women in them. Shocking, you know. So it's not just women's health, it's clinical trials for women, and women's research in general is so lacking. But, you know, we are seeing an uplift in that. Where was I going with this?
Omega-3.
So omega-3, we see that the reason I talk a lot about, you've probably heard me mention it on the podcast, people taking omega-3 to help lower inflammation. And the reason that actually works is you have two types of omegas, well, main types in the body, which is omega-3 and omega-6. Omega-6 is actually pro-inflammatory, so it drives inflammation. Mm. And actually, when we eat ultra-processed food, we put high levels of this omega-6 into our bodies. Omega-3, on the other hand, naturally you can get it from things like nuts, seeds, oily fish. That is actually anti-inflammatory. And if you have, it basically competes with the omega-6. So the more omega-3 you can put in your body, the more it's competing with the pro-inflammatory one.
We like and the number three.
Yeah, okay. We like that. Yeah, 321.
I like you're giving me like, a way of remembering it.
Yeah. But yeah, it outcompetes it. And really interestingly, there was some research that showed in women that actually had high levels of omega-3, their endometriosis symptoms were less. So that's one of the things that seems to have some robust evidence behind it. So it might be interesting. And I love the scientific approach by putting one thing at a time in.
Yes.
So it's all carefully controlled. So maybe just see if that does seem to make a difference.
Okay. Thank you. I will try.
Are you surprised by that, Emma?
The age or the...
The age.
Yeah, I am. I suppose I am and I'm not at the same time, because I kind of know it's not great right now. And I'm regularly told by people who care about me, and I, you know, I do have a lot of sort of new women who've come into my life, especially through parenting, you know, which I am very grateful for, that I've had quite a rough ride, and I need to give myself, like, cut myself some slack for that. But there aren't many opportunities to do that, you know, in all of our lives, are there? But apart from knowing that, what can one do? And apart from hopefully try things and see if things get better.
I think it's frustrating for me. You and I have the same pattern in this specific test. I'm older than you are by a decade, biologically, apparently. But when you have a chronic illness and when you have autoimmune disease, I think it is difficult to sit and listen to advice like try omega-3s. Because it's sort of like an interior designer saying, how about curtains? And you're like, my house is on fire.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that there are things you can do to reverse it. But when you have all this inflammation, it's like...
Yeah.
But what we also have in common is we're shockingly beautiful. Blonde. Really glowing skin. Do you know what I mean? Like, we don't look...
Yeah.
67.
It's confusing.
77. We're fertile. We're having baby. We have small children. Yeah. Like, it is difficult as the host of this show to come up against a test where I have been older than any subject.
Yeah, are you the oldest?
I am older than Dame Sheila Hancock.
Is that how you got this podcast?
Yes. Oldest wins. And it's like, I hope this does help listeners and there are some actionable pieces of advice that they can add to their real lives. But I get the frustration of people with chronic illness just going,
yeah,
okay, yeah, I'll try Reformer Pilates, great.
Yeah, I have a really long list on my phone that I'm meant to work through of things, although I have now done quite a lot of them, and either they're just part of my life now and one hopes they help, for instance, food, strength training, you know, but the pain was still very hard last night, for instance.
Yeah.
It's a little bit today, not so bad. So it's you don't know what's gonna, and actually, it probably won't calm down until, please God, if it does, it probably won't calm down until my cycle does switch itself off.
Yeah,
you know, however that comes about.
Yeah, and I think it, you know, in terms of, you mentioned hormone replacement therapy, again, it's trial and error. I think there is evidence that that could help, but it's unique to your body. So it's that process of going through and finding out what levels of hormones, which hormones are actually helping. And do you know what? Honestly, I wish I could come on here and say something other than omega-3, but you were talking earlier about, you know, doctors not having a clue about this. And for me as a scientist, so I sort of sit at the start of researching the things that eventually gets to doctors. And we know for a fact that doctors are around 15 years behind what is happening in the lab in early research. Mm. And in this case, even the scientists don't know what's going on. So that's how far behind we are.
This is how fucked you are. But in the meantime, try omega-3.
This is it. It's like... anything we evidence on, it's like...
Listen, there's a phrase in my line of work, news you can use.
Yeah.
I like an item that's 5 minutes long on the radio or TV where you get something from it. So I am actually grateful that you said something. Mm-hmm. Plus it was one thing. It's good when it's not like more than one.
Yeah.
And I can now introduce that. I genuinely will look into that.
Omega 321s. And you're basically going to be 67 until you don't have endometriosis anymore. So someone get on that. In spite of all that, Emma, you look 20. I know that antagonizes older women because they go, no, I don't. I look 40 and 40 looks great. Whatever. You've got lots of thin hair.
Yeah, lots of it. Yeah, we did that.
You get what you want. You're the best at what you do.
Well.
You're driven. You have these beautiful children and you still get up every day 4 hours before the earliest of us. And... you give it the business, so congratulations.
Thank you very much. I have loved meeting you.
Brilliant stuff from Emma Barnett, our guest on What's My Age Again. If you want more Emma, you can hear her on BBC Radio 4's The Today program. You can also buy her book, Maternity Service, or one of she and her husband's brilliant
coloring books. Buy them for your kids or for yourself if you want to connect with your inner child. Please follow and subscribe to the show wherever you listen or watch your podcasts, and check out our socials.
A Rayo Original Podcast.